This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, October 12th, 2011. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
KUAF and Ozarks at Large, supported by Fayetteville Athletic Club, offering a network of positive attitudes and activities for individuals, friends, and families with the desire to be the best they could be. Information regarding weight loss, personal or group training, strength training, and more is available at fayac.com or 587-0500.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, the University of Arkansas nears the end of its fourth annual food drive. And Wayne Bell, author of the Culture Club column found at FayettevilleFlyer.com, discusses VH1's list of the top 100 pop songs of the first decade of the 21st century.
But first, in mid-September, Talk Business and Hendricks College rolled out their latest round of political polling that set some benchmarks for a future look at political races on next year's ballot. That poll looks at the job approval ratings of Arkansas's four incumbent congressmen. On this edition of Ozarks, we take a look at the 3rd and 4th District. Michael Cook argues from the Democratic perspective, while Jason Tolbert takes the Republican point of view. The conversation is moderated by Roby Brock from our content partner, TalkBusiness.net.
Do you approve or disapprove of the job Congressman Steve Womack is doing in the 3rd District? 44% approve, 29% disapprove, and 27% don't know. And in the 4th District, do you approve or disapprove of the job Congressman Mike Ross is doing? 43% approve, 29% disapprove, and 28% don't know. So to both of our political pundits, what can you read from these numbers since Congressman Ross is not running for re-election?
Well, I think the biggest thing we can read is Democrats are probably very disappointed that Congressman Mike Ross is not running for re-election. Those are great numbers for the congressman. He is one of the Democrats who has really defied conventional wisdom the last few years. The tide has kind of shifted against Democrats, certainly on the national level that we've seen here in the state. We saw that happen with Blanche Lincoln in the previous election cycle. But Congressman Ross has kind of defied that wisdom. He's proven himself, and he's proven that he can convince his district that he is a conservative Democrat who listens to them. He does numerous town halls, travels his district more than probably anyone else, and the fact that he's not running for re-election has got to be a tremendous blow to Democrats in that district, because now it's most certainly in play for Republicans. We've seen two very strong candidates announced for that district in Beth Ann Rankin and Tom Cotton. Either one of them look like they could take that district. They're going to have the funds to really compete down in that district. And so the fact that he's not running for re-election is a great opportunity for Republicans to perhaps win all four districts in the state for the first time ever.
One of the things, you know, as we looked at those numbers was really intriguing in that, you know, there's a theory among the Republican Party that the 4th district, it's gone Republican, you know, Democrats can't win it. But when you start looking at the poll that we just conducted, of all the four congressional districts, when it comes to people who identify as Democrats, it was the largest spread. 33% of people we polled said they were Democratic, and only 22% identify the Republican Party. So that is a significant spread of a real Democratic influence going into this election. Now, right now, once again, Democrats don't have their act together in South Arkansas either. There's not yet an announced candidate who can take on this seat. But Mike Ross has shown the pathway to victory through his time in Congress. As you remember, he defeated Republican Jay Dickey back in 2000. You know, he's shown that as long as you're a culturally conservative, you have to also be conservative economically, that people will vote for you. And he showed it time and time again. You know, it's interesting, back in 2010, there was a Republican tidal wave that swept over Arkansas. Republicans swept into constitutional offices. They picked up a ton of seats in the state legislature. But yet the best that they can do in South Arkansas was only get 40% of the vote with a pretty well-funded Republican candidate. And looking at it, you would know Republican primary politics better than I would, but it seems like Beth Ann Rankin is the sort of the front runner for the nomination, which I think she would be a very weak general election candidate. The classic example of the Christine O'Donnell in Delaware or Sharon Angle in Nevada, it could turn out that Republicans nominate the one person that would be easily beaten. Tom Cotton would obviously be a good candidate as well, but he also could be beaten just because that district, believe it or not, is still Democratic, and going into a presidential year where turnout is high, it's a seat that we can definitely hold on to. But they have to be the right kind of candidate.
Well, I really think in that district, you have to look past the partisan label. One of the reasons I think Mike Ross had the success that he had was, if you look at his voting record 40% of the time he voted with Republicans when he was in Washington, D.C. He many, many times opposed his own party. I think it's a very conservative district, and I don't think a Democrat can win in that district unless they prove to their voters that they're conservative. I think a new Democrat that's not well known will have a lot more difficult time proving that because they don't have a track record, a voting record to run on and to point to, as Congressman Ross did. So someone coming in fresh from the ground that isn't well known, hasn't proven themselves, I think they're going to be labeled with that party of Barack Obama, President Obama, more than someone like Ross would be. And so I think the nationalization of politics in that district is, you're probably going to see that dynamic more than you may even some of the other districts.
Well, right now, none of the candidates are known. Tom Cotton is not known. Beth Ann Rankin is not known. And I would remind you that back in 2000, when Congressman Mike Ross first ran, nobody knew who he was either. He was a state senator from Prescott, Arkansas, in this massive district. So the thing about campaigns is you spend, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars so that you get known. And I think the Democratic candidate, whoever he or she will be, will have the funds, will be able to define themselves that they're Arkansas Democrat, you know, culturally conservative, and worried about what happens here in Arkansas.
Sure. Of course, I think it's a completely different dynamic this year than it was when Congressman Mike Ross ran the first time. He had President Bill Clinton flying in on Air Force One to campaign for him to try to help him win that district. I don't think Barack Obama is going to be flying in to help whatever candidate is in that district, and I don't know they would want him to do that. Bill Clinton was obviously a very positive asset for Ross whenever he ran. And, Bill Clinton is, the home state. He's from that district, grew up in that district. So that was a very positive aspect for Ross that this candidate won't have this time around. Tom Cotton, Beth Ann Rankin, you're right, they're not as well known. But Republicans don't have to prove that they're conservative. People assume most of the time that Republicans are the conservative party. They're known as being the party that's usually on the right. And that district leans to the right. And so they'll come into it with that advantage of already people thinking that they're conservatives, whereas Democrats have to almost apologize for the fact that they're Democrats.
I don't think anybody has to apologize for being a Democrat. There's no Democrat in the state that has to apologize for standing up for what they believe in terms of fighting for, you know, the middle class, which the Republican Party hasn't done a good job of over the years. So I think it's going to be a real fight. But right now, as I've said, I've conceded, Democrats don't have a candidate yet. So until they do, let's defer the conversation.
Going to be fun to watch.
It'll be definitely.
To hear what the political bloggers had to say about the remaining two incumbent congressmen from Arkansas, you can go to an audio extra at OzarksAtLarge.com.
Support for content from TalkBusiness.net on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S., today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com. And Bank of the Ozarks, offering the tools and services to make Arkansas businesses work. More information is available at BankOzarks.com. And Verizon, offering small business solutions, including high-speed mobile broadband, wireless email, global services, and push-to-talk. More information at a Verizon Communication store or online at vzw.com/small business.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Mitch McGrady.
We're inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio with Jason Sewell, who is the executive director of the Seedling Film Group.
Association.
Mm-hmm. Seedling Film Association. And Jules Taylor, who happens to be the community liaison for the same organization. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Autumn, October. Big time for Seedling because the film festival,
that's
the offshoot
right.
film festival, is this month.
It is this month. We kick off on Thursday, October the 27th, and it lasts until that Sunday, which is the 30th. So it's a full weekend of events and films and workshops, and should be a great time.
Before the festival, though, we have to find out what films will be shown in the festival.
Correct. And that is why we are hosting, this is our first gala that we are having to announce the film. So I think the gala's official title is An Affair to Remember, we're taking the theme of early Hollywood, Art Deco kind of atmosphere, and we are, that evening will be at the Matt Miller Studio, just off the square downtown Fayetteville, and we'll be announcing the films, as well as having a silent auction at the event and an evening of entertainment, music, food, drinks. It should be a really, really well done, fun night.
The idea behind announcing what has been accepted into a film festival, this happens at film festivals across the world. The idea, many have been submitted, and then you pick from that.
Well, this year we had over 150 submissions.
Wow.
Yeah.
Which is the most that we've, as an organization, ever seen. So that what that means is that our jurors had to watch all of those submissions and decide what would make it into the festival itself. So hours and hours and hours of sitting in front of your computer or in front of your TV or whatever, screening these films. And then the jury came together, I guess it was about a week ago, and had a preliminary conversation about which films would be accepted and which wouldn't. And so we are just, you know, going to announce that to the public. We're keeping it close to the chest now, but we'll announce it to the public. And hopefully that will generate a lot of excitement, a lot of buzz for the festival.
Well, why do you think so many more people participated this year?
I think it has a lot to do with that the name was recognizable. Last year was the very first year, and we still received quite a few submissions last year, but almost double this year what we had last year in terms of submissions. And so I think that the name was recognizable. People saw it. We had some people who, since last year, have already completed another film that they submitted again this year, people who want to come back, people, you know, the word got out, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, it was really great that we got all of those submissions and that name recognition in the film community.
And there were a lot of different categories that people could submit for, right?
Yes, there are plenty of categories. And all the films in the different categories are all, I guess, being judged in that category to come out with a winner. And then there'll be a best overall. But we have, I'm trying to remember them all, but we have narrative features, which is like your, you know, normal movie, I guess, if you go to the cinema. Mm-hmm. Documentaries, shorts, student films, animations. We had a low-tech category, so a film that could be made on your phone, no big budget or anything like that. Last year, we had the same category, but we got zero submissions, and this year, we did receive a few submissions in that category. And then one of the biggest for submissions was the Arkansas Connection category. So any film that could be connected to Arkansas, most of these films were actually made in Arkansas, but there were a few that, you know, the person starring in the movie was from Arkansas or whatever. So a lot of local filmmakers and a lot of people from across the state, hopefully anxiously awaiting to find out if they will be, their films will be seen at the end of October.
And it was very international submissions. I mean, we got submissions from Spain and Australia and Portugal. It was pretty exciting. So we got them from all over the world, really.
Yeah. Wow. Well, how did they hear about you all over the world? That's pretty exciting.
That's a great question, Antoinette. There's a program online called Without a Box,
mm-hmm.
That most film festivals use for submissions.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we put our name out there on Without a Box, and anybody from across the world who's a filmmaker, because it has become kind of the industry standard for submitting films to a film festival, you go to Without a Box, could see us and see our film festival, read a description of what it's about, and decide if they'd like to submit to that festival or not. So we did. We received, I believe it was somewhere upwards around 9 countries submitted this year. So you know, as close as Canada and as far away as Australia, filmmakers were submitting to us.
So on the 14th, at An Affair to Remember, you'll announce how many, can you tell us how many films have been accepted?
Well, I can tell you that the number of hours of films, I mean, we're looking at about, 50 hours worth of film throughout the 4-day weekend. So, I mean, that's a lot.
You still have to pare down 150 films. That's at least, you know, almost probably close to 300 hours worth. So that's a lot of making decisions.
Yeah, absolutely.
About what to program in.
And speaking of programming too, this year, excuse me, we were able to, we brought on board an education coordinator, and this person is Trent Jones, who works at Springdale Harbor, and he is in charge of their film program there. And he has, I just want to toot his horn for a second. He's done a phenomenal job of getting us out there and creating a whole educational package, an educational component that went out to schools. So not only just schools in this area, but he reached up into southern Missouri and down into the rest of the state of Arkansas and, you know, out into other areas as well where he had contacts. Putting all of this stuff out there. So students, and mainly high school students, but then again some college students and some film students even, could submit their films, and the fee was a little bit different for the student submission. But those films during the day on Thursday and Friday is going to be a whole educational component, with not only just showing and showing those student films, but also flying in workshop presenters and people to come be a part of this. One person named Darren Fletcher is coming in from California, and he works for a company called ISM Films, and they're coming in to do a whole slew of workshops, particularly geared towards your high school student learner in film. And so Thursday and Friday are going to be very exciting. Lots and lots of teenagers, hopefully, will be all learning together at the Global Campus Building on the square.
Last year, the Offshoot Film Festival, it wasn't scattered, but it was at multiple venues. This year, one-stop shopping, all at the Global...
At the Global Campus.
Which used to be called Continuing Ed. Right. Mm-hmm.
And so we're real excited about that because it's a great building. It's a beautiful space for the main theater where to watch films. But there's classroom space, so we can have a whole lot of things going on at the same time. And it's right downtown, right on our beautiful square. So that's always great to be able to show that off to anybody who comes in from out of town.
So last year, if I wanted to see film A, I might have been in this building, and film B was somewhere else. This year, you know, if you're going to see the films,
you're all in the same place.
Same thing. You can get a whole film festival pass.
Absolutely. Yeah. Film festival passes are $35, and that includes workshops. And even these workshops that I'm saying that are for educational purposes are still open to the public, so anybody can go in there. And so, yeah, $35 pass gets you into our film screenings, workshops, and after parties that we have. And that's a great opportunity to hang out with the filmmakers.
Mm-hmm. And that's a really great thing to do, to come and hang out with everybody, mm-hmm. the filmmakers, but also like us and the community. You know, people are... How we love to hang out with each other in our community.
Absolutely. And one of the things about Seedling as an organization is that we are still, one of our main goals is to grow the independent film community here in Northwest Arkansas, people who are interested or who have worked in the industry before. And we want all of those people hanging out in the same place, because then there's projects that happen. You know, oh, you do this, I do that. Let's get together and let's make a movie and I can help you do this. And, you know, all of those good things with that come from communicating with each other will happen during the film festival.
Oh, you know, last year you had this guy, this mascot. Is he going to be back?
Oh, Sprout.
Yeah.
Wait, who's the mascot?
He was a green guy, head to toe. Green.
Okay.
Right?
His name is Sprout. Mm-hmm.
His name is Sprout,
and he represents the seed.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm sure Sprout will be making some appearances during the film fest.
Yeah. And
gotta have Sprout.
Probably on the 14th as well. He likes to be in front of the public as much as possible.
He likes to get his photo made with as many people as possible. Mm-hmm. That's one of his goals.
I will have to meet the Sprout.
Yes, you will.
Jules, Jason, thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Earth, sky.
We might not be aware of how much water we use every day. That's according to Charles Fishman, investigative journalist and contributing editor at Fast Company. Fishman interviewed dozens of water experts around the world for his new book, The Big Thirst.
Especially as people rise into the middle class and in developed nations, there's lots of hidden water use. So an example is, in the United States, the average person in the course of a day uses 99 real gallons of water.
That is 99 gallons of water for cooking, cleaning, and bathing. Fishman added that we use water in ways that we might not even think about or know about.
The electricity that each American uses just at home, this is just residential electricity per person, that electricity requires 250 gallons of water a day. So you use more than twice as much water just to keep your computer and your light bulbs and your refrigerator and your flat screen TV running as you do to actually take a bath and cook and clean the dishes and go to the bathroom.
The better we understand our hidden water use, Fishman said, the easier it will be for the public to make smart decisions about water use and conservation. Fishman said challenges to our water supply will grow this century because of the effects of climate and a growing population. More at our website with Charles Fishman. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
It's Wednesday, the 12th of October, 2011. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
We're inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio, and with us, Becca Bacon-Martin, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Who's going to be really hard to find the rest of this week if I can make it happen.
Because you're going to find yourself with some craft fair stuff.
This is crafts fair week, and it makes me happy. Today is the first one at Spanker Creek Farm in Bentonville, 8 to 5 today. It continues through Sunday. War Eagle Mill and War Eagle and Sharp Show at War Eagle all start tomorrow and continue through Sunday out by the river. The Northwest Arkansas Medical Auxiliary Arts and Crafts Fair at the Jones Center in Springdale is Thursday through Saturday. I'm turning the page because you know I can't remember all of these. Frisco Station Mall is Thursday through Sunday in Rogers. The Ozark Regional Arts and Crafts Festivals, there are two of them, from 9 to 9 on Friday and Saturday only at the Northwest Arkansas Convention Center in Springdale and the Embassy Suites Convention Center in Rogers. Always really good stuff at those. And the Woodcarvers of Northwest Arkansas have a show and sale from 9 to 5 Saturday and 10 to 4 Sunday at the Benton County Fairgrounds in Bentonville, and I will see you there.
So some but not all begin today. But not all go through Sunday. But Friday and Saturday, they're all
Friday
happening.
Saturday,
those are the big days.
Friday and Saturday are the big days. They are not the absolute insane three football games on the same day sort of craziness that they used to be.
Yeah, I haven't been for a couple of years, but I went 2 or 3 years ago, and it was a wholly pleasurable experience.
Yes, they are a little
stressful.
More chill.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they're great fun. My favorite thing to look for is that thing that you've never seen before.
Now, I'm about to blow your mind because I went 3 or 4 years ago and I spent...
Mind blown.
But wait for it. I was there with several people. Spent probably total of 4 or 5 hours.
Wow.
Spent nothing. The people I with did. I don't advocate that because you want to support the craftsmen and artisans.
Well, but I can totally believe that happened because there are just so many things to look at. You want to see it all, and so you can just
It's very hard.
It's very hard. Yeah. I mean, you want to get through all of it, and so you just kind of keep walking and looking
at
everything.
And then all of a sudden,
it's all fascinating.
You got to get home.
I guess my favorite craft fair memory is that my mother-in-law and I once lied to my father-in-law and pretended that our watches stopped.
Nice. Yeah.
All right.
See how that works this year.
Thanks, Becca. Becca Bacon-Martin is the features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
The University of Arkansas's fourth annual food drive that started on September 16th will end this Friday. A longer lunch based on the free kitchen concept followed by the six will mark the end of the drive and celebrate World Food Day in advance. Ozarks at Large's Ithi Agnihotri-Madolker talked with Dr. Nick Brown, director of the University of Arkansas's Office for Campus Sustainability, to find out more.
Last year, about 50 million Americans lived in a household that was defined as food insecure, meaning that at some point in the year they didn't know exactly where the food would be coming from for next week's meals or perhaps tonight's meals.
Dr. Nick Brown is the director of the Office for Campus Sustainability at the University of Arkansas. The office, in partnership with other campus organizations, is hosting a lunch this Friday to mark the end of the University of Arkansas's fourth annual food drive.
For the past 4 years, we've held food drives in conjunction with World Food Day, which is a program of the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization. World Food Day will be observed on October 16th this year. That's a Sunday, and we'll observe this on campus on Friday, October 14th. To bring the issue to life, the Office for Campus Sustainability is, and many partners on campus and off campus across Northwest Arkansas, manage food collection boxes. So we have about 20 or 22 boxes out across the region, and we'll collect food that will eventually be distributed to our Full Circle food pantry on our campus and to the Northwest Arkansas Food Bank.
All donated food items will be matched on a 10-to-1 basis up to 60,000 pounds by Tyson Foods, the event's main sponsor. Dr. Brown says due to the consistent efforts of campus organizations and partners, the drive will collect over 100,000 pounds of donated food items. The Friday lunch will mark the culmination of the food drive and the celebration of World Food Day, which is on October 16th. It'll be a langar lunch, a tradition initiated by the Sikh religion that originated in India.
The Sikhs provide a langar lunch. Langar is Punjabi for free kitchen. It's not a soup kitchen, and it doesn't only serve poor people. It serves anyone and everyone who wants to come in to have lunch. The lunches are vegetarian. Vegetarian not for some purpose that the Sikhs have per se, but they've determined that vegetarian meals are by far the most inclusive. So whoever you are when you come in, the typical staples are rice, beans or lentils, flatbread, whatever vegetables local farmers and other contributors may have contributed to the kitchen, and typically just water.
According to Dr. Nick Brown, the first Langar Lunch on the U of A campus was hosted 4 years ago by the Sam M. Walton College of Business's Applied Sustainability Center. He says it is a way for the privileged members of society to empathize with the lesser fortunate who don't have enough to eat. The event will also feature Ed Nicholson, the Director of Community Relations for Tyson Foods, and Julia Lyon, Student Manager for the Full Circle Campus Food Pantry, as guest speakers. On being asked how people can help, Dr. Brown had this to add.
The Northwest Arkansas Food Bank, which services over 100 food pantries in our region, distributed about 2,500 tons of food last year alone, and they serve thousands of families and households in our area. So it is a local problem as well as one that is a global problem. For example, among their clients, over 40% reported that they really have to choose between paying for food and paying for utilities or for heating. They have to choose between paying for food or for medical care. So it is a problem that we have right here in our community, and being aware of it is certainly the first step. And secondly, there are food pantries in many neighborhoods in Fayetteville and beyond, and you can contribute food items to the pantry.
The Langar Lunch will be hosted for the U of A campus community members at noon this Friday in the Arkansas Union Room 507. It is free and will be vegetarian, keeping in line with the true Langar Lunch spirit. To RSVP, email Dr. Nick Brown at nick.brown@uark.edu. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Iti Agnihotri Mudholkar.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Callums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Support for KUAF is provided by War Eagle Mill, hosting the 2011 War Eagle Mill Arts and Crafts Fair October 13th through the 16th. Booths open at 8 a.m. with a variety of handcrafts, arts, and food. More information is available on the web at wareaglemill.com.
A small collection of Fayetteville voters turned out to the polls to continue a tax that was already on the books. The measure passed with almost 75% of the votes cast in favor of continuing the measure. The tax will continue until at least 2023, when it would be required for voters to again extend the tax. City officials had urged voters to vote for keeping the tax. That's been a major revenue source for Fayetteville. Just under 3,300 voters went to the polls. That's fewer than 8% of eligible voters in the city.
A four-year federal investigation into drug trafficking and corruption in the Arkansas Delta has come to a head. More than 50 people were arrested yesterday, including five police officers who allegedly guarded drug shipments. At a news conference in Helena, West Helena yesterday, U.S. Attorney Christopher Thayer said the arrests are just the first phase of an investigation being called Operation Delta Blues.
I tell you all that from this day forward, at least as long as I'm United States Attorney, the entire weight of my office in particular, and the entire weight of the federal government in general, along with our state partners like Governor Beebe, Colonel Howard, and the Arkansas State Police, we are here in all of the Arkansas Delta, and we are here to stay until each and every one of those weeds are pulled up by the roots.
Thayer says 800 federal and state officers joined forces to make the arrests. 14 suspects are still being sought.
Six area high school cross-country teams have a bigger budget today after receiving checks from an annual Northwest Arkansas running event. The 23rd annual Chili Pepper Cross-Country Festival raises money for the cross-country programs at high schools in Bentonville, Springdale, Rogers, and Fayetteville. Yesterday, the schools officially received that money. Jay Lewis, the race director for the Chili Pepper, helped present the checks yesterday.
Total of $36,000 to the schools. And then for the life of the event, since back in the 80s when Joe came up with this idea, that's going to be about $240,000 back to the schools.
Each of the six school cross-country teams received $6,000. Coaches say the money raised by the running festival helps the high school teams travel to out-of-state meets. And for some programs, the money doubles or even triples the annual budget. The actual collegiate, high school, and open community races are scheduled for Saturday morning at the University of Arkansas cross-country course in Fayetteville. We'll have more about the Chili Pepper Festival on Friday's edition of Ozarks at Large.
State Insurance Commissioner Jay Bradford says a new hybrid form of health insurance exchange could be the only option left in Arkansas. Governor Beebe recently decided not to seek federal money for the program, which is required under the health care overhaul. If the state doesn't form its own insurance exchange, Arkansas could face the prospect of one set up by the federal government. But Bradford says Washington is now proposing an exchange that would be operated by the feds, with many regulatory functions remaining at the state level.
Unfortunately, we're at a position here in Arkansas where we can't apply for the funds for the Arkansas exchange at this point. Now, am I giving up? Not really. There's another window in December to ask for further money. Now, our request may be, if the legislature signs off on it, to do this partnership.
Bradford says he would still prefer to form and operate his own exchange at the state level.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Wayne Bell. He is the author of the column Culture Club that can be found at FayettevilleFlyer.com. Wayne, welcome back. It's hard to believe that the 2000s are already old enough to where you can legitimately have a list of the best songs of the 2000s so far. But we're more than 11 years in. VH1 did that.
Yeah, they did it last week, and I thought it was really fun because I'm a sucker for those VH1 marathons of, 100 greatest this or 100 greatest that or best of the 90s or I love the 80s or whatever. And so you do look, and some of them are a little odd here and there, but for the most part, it's pretty sound, and there's a few stinkers in there, but all in all, I thought it was a really... I'm a sucker for nostalgia, so...
It's interesting. You can find the list now online as well. So what'd you think of the list? It's topped with the Beyoncé, Jay-Z song Crazy in Love.
Yeah, and it's interesting because when they had a lot of music critics vote and music industry people, and then they also had a list of, say, 500 songs online on VH1.com, and everyday people could vote, and I voted for my, top choices, and Crazy in Love was my top choice, too. So I was kind of surprised that that ended up being number one because I thought there might be some other things that would come across higher than that. But in the end, I was really glad that it did. And I think that it's a real game changer. Because I remember when it first came on, it was so aggressive with its horn section, and it was really the debut of her, Beyonce. And
not as part of
you know, a group like she had been. It was her debut as a solo artist, and she, you know, she kind of ruled the decade as far as that's concerned. So and then just the way the whole album or the whole song is put together and produced, I think it's a real game changer as far as pop music. So.
And it's a very, when you look at the list that these people put together that voted on and VH1 showed, it reminds me much of the 1960s, mm-hmm. where obviously rap didn't exist in the 60s, but you would have a Motown song up next to you know, a singer-songwriter kind of song. And when you look at this list, you'll see U2.
Right.
You'll see Coldplay.
Right.
But then you see Lady Gaga,
yeah.
and a lot of Beyonce, a lot of Jay-Z.
Yeah, well, they really did dominate. And I think, you know, there were a few that surprised me that they were as low as they were. Not that I'm a huge Britney Spears fan, but I kind of thought Toxic would be way up there in the top five just because it was so infectious.
See, funny, Toxic being infectious. Of all the songs that are in the top 20, I saw that and went, really? That even matters. I remember it was on the radio a lot, but that seems, I don't think that's a song that will be remembered as well 20 years from now as
some of the other choices.
Right.
Right. That one was one that surprised me that it was low. The other one that surprised me that was low, and I really thought, I didn't put it in my top choice, but I thought it was definitely a top 10, and I really felt like it probably was going to be number one, was Gnarls Barkley's Crazy, and I think it came in at 14.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really surprised by that because I know a lot of people, you know, feel like that was the seminal pop album of the decade.
That's what I would have picked.
Oh.
As my number one.
Yeah, but now some of the other choices that were up high, you know, as we said, Beyonce's Crazy in Love was number one, but there were other choices that were way up there. I know that number two is Outkast, Hey Ya, mm-hmm. and that definitely... It's funny that song would be so high and so well regarded, and yet it's a song that sounds nothing new or like something that should have been in the decade.
Right, right.
And the same thing could be said for Crazy in Love in a way, because when it came out, it sounded almost retro in a way with the horn section and everything. And so I think it's funny that those two songs are so high up on the list, one and two, and yet they don't sound, you know, what we would think of as new or cutting edge. Other songs that were up high in the list were Eminem's Lose Yourself, mm-hmm. which, you know, is an Oscar winner.
Right.
Not that he accepted, but it is an Oscar winner. Kelly Clarkson, Since You've Been Gone, which I definitely agree would be way up there. I think that's it's just such an infectious pop song.
Which is what this list really has a lot of. And you look back on the music from 2000, 2010, and these songs, and if you listen to pop radio at all, almost all of these are ingrained, you know, in your brain, into Club by 50 Cent and things like that.
Lady Gaga.
Right.
Yeah.
TikTok.
She was definitely up there, yeah.
It seems overwhelmingly upbeat
right.
and fast. There aren't that many slower songs on
There's
this list.
There's a few that surprised me, like Johnny Cash is Hurt.
I'm so glad that was
on there. And Bruce Springsteen's The Rising.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, and people could definitely look at a list like that and say, this is ridiculous or this is silly, but it is popular songs.
Right.
So let's not try to say it's the best song. And you know, there's no Dixie Chicks, or there's no I think there's one Chili Peppers representation, but
right.
you know, this is popular songs. And so, yeah, I mean, down around the bottom, you're going to get some kind of silly stuff like, you know, Pussycat Dolls or Cisco or something like that. But, you know, up towards the top, you really do start to look. And I think that the winner, or not the winner, but the best songs on the list, and when I'm trying to think of what I think are my favorites of these, I look and say, which ones could I hear on the radio right now and not want to drive off the edge of the road?
Exactly.
And I think Crazy in Love is a great song, Since You've Been Gone. Those songs, you know, they're the ones that, although they've been played to death, they're still, you know, really great songs at their root.
Much like you hear, I heard it through the grapevine now.
Mm-hmm.
Marvin Gaye and you go, oh, that's a great song.
Right.
Or Al Green or something like that. I think many on this list, 20 years from now, you'll hear and go, oh, that was a great song.
Yeah.
When you look at this list and you'll see something like Crazy by Gnarls Barkley and Hurt by Johnny Cash, Rehab, Amy Winehouse, mm-hmm. and then Norah Jones, are there any stations left? Because 30, 40 years ago, those would have all been top hits and you could have heard them on the same station. Is there a radio station? Are there many radio stations that would play Don't Know Why by Norah Jones backed up by Hollaback Girl? They're both popular songs.
It's still amazing to me that Norah Jones got radio play. I mean, it's still that shocking to me. And some of these songs that I looked at and I say, it's still shocking to me. I mean, they're good artists. She certainly was helped by the Grammys. They're great artists. But the fact that they got radio play is shocking to me. And I think that that is a testament to what you're saying, which is it's amazing to me that they could find 100 songs to put on the list, because if you listen to popular radio right now,
it's so segmented.
Well, and you would also think that there are only 5 songs released per year, because it's the same songs over and over and over. And I don't have to tell our listeners that. But, you know, I would encourage our listeners who, you know, aren't going to be the ones that roll their eyes at pop music, I would encourage them to look at the list and listen to the albums, because I would venture to say the top 20 or so, they're pretty good songs and they're good representations and they're songs that you can hear years from now and go, that's still a good song.
And I think you'll look back and say, you know what? 2000 to 2010,
wasn't that bad.
That was a pretty good decade for pop music.
Yeah, it wasn't that bad. Any decade that can give us Crazy in Love and Umbrella, and, you know, you can roll your eyes at those songs, but at their heart, you know, they're really well-produced songs, and so it wasn't that shabby.
Good for tapping the dashboard.
There you go.
Thank you, Wayne.
Thank you.
My baby don't mess around me, she loves me so.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
And joining us now in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Kevin Kinder, features reporter at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Greetings. Nice to be here.
Hello.
Thanks for coming back. We're talking about a piece of yours that's going to run in the paper Sunday, the morning news.
That's right.
Did you catch up with the architect of Crystal Bridges?
I sure did. And, you know, one of the things that we noticed as we're getting ready for this museum to open is how remarkable the design is. And we know that people are talking about it. So what we wanted to do is dig in a little bit about what the building is, who completed it, and how we're going to get sort of this world-class building in a creek in Bentonville.
And Moshe Safdie, the architect.
That's right. And you know, he's been designing for years. He met with Alice after she saw one of his buildings in California. And they walked through the site, and instead of going through the whole letting and bidding process like you would imagine would happen in such a multi-million dollar project, she basically said at the end of their walkthrough of the site, well, send your plans to me. You're my guy.
Mm-hmm. This guy must be amazingly charming and convincing, and what an intellect, because in September, the Kauffman Performing Arts Center opened in Kansas City.
He's actually got 4 openings this fall, including the Crystal Bridges on November 11th. As you mentioned, the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts opened September 16th in Kansas City. He's also got 2 other dedications this fall, and that's at the it's a heritage center in India. And he also has the United States Institute of Peace, and that's on the National Mall in Washington, D.C.,
Well, when the story – it's interesting. The story behind the Kauffman Performing Arts Center is much like Crystal Bridges. He met with a member of the Kauffman family, and she showed him the space and said, what would you do with it? He took a napkin. He drew it, this, which is what it looks like now. In about 45 seconds, she said, you got the job.
And similarly, he got the job. He told me that he submitted a couple different designs, and Alice liked the one that we ended up with. It is named Crystal Bridges because it does two things. One, it spans what's called Crystal Spring, which is a naturally flowing spring in that area through a ravine. And two, the bridge element is what he designed, and it's two copper top structures that span over the top of this ravine. And if you've looked at the site plans, there are several buildings that reside on what will be the Crystal Bridges complex. And as it spans this man-made pond, they decided to call them the Bridges of Crystal Bridges. And so there are several galleries. It is meant to combine art and nature. There are these moments in between. You're in the gallery and you're looking at art, and then you're walking into the next gallery space. You'll be looking at the natural surroundings. You'll be looking at the wooded forest. You'll be looking at the water. And he wanted these sort of transformative moments in between these two elements. And he told me one of the interesting elements, if you look at some of his previous design, they're very urban. And he's based in Boston. He's been designing habitats, including what probably got him on the map, which is called Habitat 67. It's in Montreal, Canada, and basically it's a bunch of blocks stacked on top of each other. He's also recently doing some similar work in Asia, sort of coming full circle. But this project specifically is kind of unique for him because it's in less of an urban area and a little bit more suburban. And frankly, if you've been to the site, you know that it's suburban doesn't really do it justice. Mm-hmm. It's sort of away from everything. Even though it's really close to Bentonville's downtown, it's a really unique location, sort of on a wooded hillside. And
he feels secluded a little bit.
It really does. And you can take a walking trail and go down there through it, and it's really going to be remarkable. He tells me he considers it one of his best works to date. And he's been, you know, his one of his first projects was in 1967. So you can understand how long he's been doing this, and he really feels that this is one of his signature projects.
And we're getting closer.
We are. November 11th, 2011. And, you know, he says that work is still ongoing out there, and they're working on that, you know, almost 24 hours a day. The real transformative element will be when they release the water that they've taken away from the ravine right now and run it under the bridges that they've constructed out there. We're really getting close to that, and it's going to be, I think, a phenomenal building and situation here for all of us.
And so your conversation with Moshe Safdie, parts of that will be in the paper Sunday.
That's correct.
Thank you, Kevin.
Kevin Kinder is a features writer for Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 12th of October, 2011. It was on this day, 1892, the Pledge of Allegiance was recited en masse, first time, more than 2 million students. It had been written just a month before by a Baptist minister named Francis Bellamy, published it in a magazine, Youth's Companion, and distributed it across the country. It was a little bit shorter in 1892. I pledge allegiance to my flag and the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. It was revised to read the flag of the United States of America in 1923, and then the words under God were added in 1954. Under God was added because President Dwight D. Eisenhower had attended a sermon by the Reverend George Dougherty, who said that apart from the mention of the United States of America, it could be a pledge of any republic. In fact, he could hear little Moscow children repeating a similar pledge to the hammer and sickle flag in Moscow. And so Eisenhower was convinced, and within a few months, they included the words under God as a way to distinguish this Pledge of Allegiance from one in the Soviet Union. It's the birthday of the poet and translator Robert Fitzgerald, born Springfield, Illinois, 1910. He went off to the Choate School in Connecticut, when he was a young man, met the classics teacher and translator Dudley Fitts, was so impressed by him, he went to Harvard because Fitts had gone there. Eventually became a beloved professor there, translated the Odyssey and the Iliad, the Aeneid, had a wide circle of literary friends, including Robert Lowell, and it was Lowell who introduced Robert Fitzgerald and his wife Sally to a young writer, a Catholic writer named Flannery O'Connor, who came to live with the Fitzgeralds in Connecticut for almost 2 years, working on a novel. After she left, she wrote to the Fitzgeralds, who were expecting a baby. She wrote, "I hope this one will be a girl and have a fierce Old Testament name and cut off a lot of heads. You had better stay down and take care of yourself. Your children sound big enough to do all the work. By beating them moderately and moderately often, you should be able to get them in the habit of doing domestic chores." Here's a poem for today by Julie Cadwallader Staub, entitled "If Life Were Like Touch Football." Driving north on Route 2A from Vermont to Maine, listening to the news, the New England Patriots coach was caught trying to videotape the hand signals of the New York Giants. I remember how we six sisters would recruit a few boys from the neighborhood for a pickup game of touch football in the street, how we'd break into teams, huddle around whomever was chosen to be quarterback, how the quarterback would extend her left palm flat into the middle of the huddle, plant the index finger of her right hand in the center of her palm, and then with finger motions and whispers, she would diagram who was to go where and when in order to so confuse and fool the other team that one of us could break free and go long. Oh, that feeling of running as fast as I could, extending my arms, my hands, my fingers as far as I could, watching that spiraling bullet of a football, reminding myself, if you can touch it, you can catch it. If you can touch it, you can catch it. If Life Were Like Touch Football, a poem by Julie Cadwallader Staub from her collection Face to Face, published by Dream Seeker Books and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, where your mobile device can turn into a virtual poetry library with the Poetry Foundation's Poetry app. You can find it online at poetryfoundation.org. And by CSX, transporting 2 billion pounds of goods to market by train and working to help move the economy forward. CSX, How Tomorrow Moves. Edited by Noah Smith and written by Betsy Allister. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support for Ozarks at Large and KUAF is provided by the Malco Cinema Razorback Theater, featuring the Met Opera live in HD, presenting Anna Bolena on Saturday, October 15th. That's this Saturday at 11:45 a.m. Tickets and more information available on the web at malco.com.
KUAF is also supported by Northwest Arkansas Media, the publishing source for the region's daily news, including the Arkansas Democrat Gazette Northwest Arkansas Edition, the Benton County Daily Record, the Rogers and Springdale Morning News, and the Northwest Arkansas Times. More information is available at nwaonline.com.
Tomorrow, another new edition of Ozarks at Large. Ithi Agnihotri-Madulker will be with me. I'd tell you what's on the show, but right now I can't remember. Plenty of stuff.
Well, you'll talk to Jody and Tilly.
Yes, Michael Tilly from thecitywire.com and Jody Beznoska from Walton Heart Center, of course, and there's more.
Yes, but that's what we do every week as well.
That's right. That's right. I promise it'll be a full show tomorrow.
A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Cross Lanes.
Where in the world is Cross Lanes?
It is northeast of Fort Smith.
Okay. I don't think I've ever been to Cross Lanes. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Hitchmet Grada.
And we will have more about the Chili Pepper Running Festival on Friday's edition of Ozarks at Large. Until then,
have a great day.